What chapter?
There you go.
Okay, we're about to read and discuss what we can of the book of Micah. Micah was contemporary with Hosea, Amos, and Isaiah. They all prophesied around the same time, but Micah was a little later. He started a little later. Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah all started during the time of Azariah, King Azariah of Judah, who's also known as Uzziah. And now Micah is starting a little later in the time of Jotham, and Jotham was the son of Uzziah. We read in 2 Chronicles chapter 26 that Uzziah slept with his fathers, and Jotham's son reigned in his stead. And Jotham was 25 years old when he began and reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. In this there's a lot of problems with chronology, and the mainstream, we go to great lengths to try to patch it together, and some of them don't do it very well. So I have just as an example in this chronology that Uzziah reigned for 52 years from 791 to 739 BC. And then Jotham reigned for 16 years from 752 to 736 BC. Scripture doesn't leave any space the way it's presented for that 13-year overlap. So there were problems that we don't really understand co-regency in Judah. When the king reigned 52 years, perhaps he was getting user old, your channel. And his son reigned with him, together with him, for 6 or 8 or 10 years, and that's very possible, but we're not given that information explicitly anywhere in Scripture. The number of years of each king don't fit in between certain historical events that we know from other sources when they happened. We have to assume that there were co-regencies, that perhaps some of those 16 years of Jotham were with his father, Uzziah. So that's just an example of that trouble. But there's no doubt that Micah began to prophesy just time after those other three prophets, Hosea, Amos, and Isaiah, all started in the time of Uzziah. And Micah's just a little later, but the others are still prophesying at this time when Micah starts. So all four of these prophets were active in Judah and Israel, because Amos was mostly in Israel and Hosea was mostly in Israel. They were all active in Judah and Israel at this time, begins his prophecy. That's all I have to say to introduce Micah. It's about 740-something or 750-something B.C., no later than 736 B.C. Samaria, a lot of Israel has already been taken into captivity starting in 743 B.C. And Samaria is not destroyed until 721 B.C. or maybe 722. Most of Micah's prophecy is against Samaria and Israel. That's good.
You're breaking up just a little bit, Bill.
I'm sorry. I really can't control that at all. Try to switch my... I have to rely on my phone.
It was all right. It's just the very ending there.
Okay. That's all I have to say right now.
All right. Prophecy of Micah. The word of Yahweh that came to Micah, the Morathite, in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Hear, all you people, hearken, O earth, and all that therein is. and let Yahweh God be witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, Yahweh comes forth out of his place and will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. And the mountains shall be molten under him, and the valleys shall be cleft as wax before the fire, and as the waters that are poured down a steep place. Transgression of Jacob is all this, and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? Therefore I will make Samaria as a heap of the field and as plantings of a vineyard, and I will pour down the stones thereof into the valley, and I will discover the foundations thereof. And all the graven images thereof shall be beaten to pieces, and all the hires thereof shall be burned with the fire, and all the idols thereof will I lay desolate. For she gathered it of the hire of a harlot, and they shall return to the hire of a harlot. Therefore I will wail and howl, I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the dragons, and mourning as the owls. For her wound is incurable, for it is come unto Judah. He is come unto the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. Declare you it not at Gath, yeep ye not at all. In the house of Ephrah, roll yourself in the dust. Pass you away, you inhabitant of Saphir, having your shame naked. The inhabitant of Zanan came not forth in the morning of Bethesel. He shall receive of you his standing. For the inhabitant of Marath waited carefully for his good, for good. But evil came down from Yahweh unto the gate of Jerusalem. O you inhabitant of Lachish, bind the chariot to the swift beast. She is the beginning of the sin to the daughter of Zion. For the transgressions of Israel were found in thee. Therefore shall you give presents to Moresheth Gath. The houses of Akzib shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. Yet will I bring an heir unto thee, O inhabitant of Marishah. He shall come unto Adullam, the glory of Israel. Make thee bald, and pull thee for thy delicate children. Enlarge your baldness as the eagle, for they are gone into captivity from you. End of Micah chapter 1.
I'm sorry. I'm looking. There are several axes described as a Moreshite, and this place, Moresheth Gath, means possession of Gath. Probably why it's probably Micah's hometown and why he's called a Moreshite here or Moreshite. This Moresheth Gath, several sources tell me that it was in Judah. That there was a Gath, of course, mentioned often in scripture, all the way from through the books of Samuel and Kings, and it seems to be in Judah. I don't have a problem with that. I just don't know where it is in Judah. User entered your channel. I just am not familiar with the location of the place. I apologize for that. Maybe somebody else is, and they could be more than welcome to comment. This oracle against Samaria, if Micah began prophesying in the earliest time of Jotham, because Jotham ruled 16 years, we don't know really when he began prophesying, then it was fulfilled within 30 years and Samaria was made. Samaria was torn down and its inhabitants were deported. I believe that 23,000, in Assyrian increase, 23,000 people were deported by the Assyrians from Samaria alone, from the city of Samaria alone, when it was taken by Sargon II in about 722 BC.
These places are being mentioned for poetic reasons, right, Bill?
Yes, a lot of them are mentioned for poetic reasons because of the meanings of their names. And I didn't pull out commentary, but I believe that I did comment on that at length in reference to Micah several years ago. I could go look for that.
Yeah, you did. I was just trying to see if I remembered it correctly.
Yeah, definitely. I read that.
Well, it was a good prompt. I needed it, evidently, but I have to do these programs off the cuff. I can't possibly prepare for them. I'm sorry. It's an informal Bible discussion. But most of these names are being used. Judah, and they're all sinners. They're all sinning, and they're all going to be destroyed or taken into captivity. That's already been seen by the prophets before.
You're breaking up a lot now, Bill. You're breaking up a lot now. I couldn't hear any of that. The last thing you said.
I'm sorry. I'm going to try to change my internet connection and see if that does me any good.
Well, while you do that, I'll look up your commentary for the names. But it's interesting here how the people microphone are scared activated. To come out of their city. That's what happens with a sinful city, is the enemy surrounds you and is strengthened against you, and they're afraid to come out. That feels a lot like today.
Well, verse 13 of the inhabitants of Lachish means invincible, and it says that she is the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion. So that arrogance that the Israelites felt that they were invincible and they could basically do anything and they were still going to be under God's grace. I think that's what verse 13 is referring to. Which is what he mentions in his commentary on it.
Yeah, in his commentary, it says the meaning of the word Lachish could not be identified by strong, but newer lexicons say that it means impregnable or invincible.
Yeah, I mean, Bill pointed that out, I think, 10 years ago, roughly.
I'm sorry, I'm busy trying to switch my internet connection. Is Lachish the first city mentioned here? Yes. Verse 13.
I mean, it isn't the first city, but it does say that that was the beginning of sin.
They thought they were invincible. That's the sort of connotations Bill mentions in his commentary. Pride goeth before destruction.
Right.
Because Lachish was invincible.
Right, because they knew they had the favor of Yahweh. They felt like no matter what they did, he would still be favorable to them.
Yeah, they didn't realize they had to keep his law to have his temporal protection.
Yeah.
Well, they were told that. They were told that, though. They were warned. They just didn't heed the warnings. Lachish, what's interesting about Lachish is that Lachish was actually put under siege by Sennacherib later on after the fall of Samaria, and Lachish surrendered to him and was used as his base of operations while he took 46 fenced cities of Judah. Lachish was his base of operations during that time.
And don't we have like ancient letters from Lachish about that battle or something?
The ancient letters are actually, I believe they're a little later in between the Assyrian and Babylonian period. I might be mistaken about that. They're called the Lachish Ostraca, and I would rather look them up on my website than somewhere else because I've already done this research. I believe it was perhaps for my Amos commentary. So let me try to dig that out. Yeah, it's in Amos part 4.
And I think that's in Hezekiah, the king of the time of Hezekiah, the king of Judah. Like I said, that's when Lachish was used as his base of operations. Providence of Lachish Astraga, sometimes known as the Lachish letters, are well known. Their authenticity is not questioned, and the findings again help to establish that the narrative concerning the history of Lachish, as presented by the Bible, is indeed accurate, and that Israelite worshippers of Yahweh dwelt there up until the time of the Babylonian sieges upon the remnants of Judah left by the Assyrians. The following is a text of the Lachish Astraga from ancient Near Eastern texts. These Astraga were discovered in the ruins of the latest Israelite occupation at Tel Ed Duir, that would be the site of ancient Lachish, in southern Palestine. There were 21 of these Astraga in all, and Astraga are just broken pieces of pottery that people typically saved and used to scribble notes on to send them to somebody else. So nearly all of the Astraga come from the latest occupation level of the Israelite Gate Tower. They're generally placed immediately before the beginning of the Chaldean siege of Lachish, perhaps in the autumn of 589. And they were notes that were being sent because they were watching for the Babylonians to invade. They were watching for the Chaldeans to invade because they knew again that they were being rebellious to Babylon, so they expected an invasion. So the Lachish letters come a little later in history than where we're at here, 140 years later, perhaps. But Lachish was used as a base of operations for Sennacherib, as he had been attacking and deporting all the people of Judah. And those 46 fenced cities and several hundred thousand people into captivity from Judah. So here, I guess it's 40 or 50 years before that time, and Lachish thought it was invincible.
And then where
it says the houses. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Bill.
Where it speaks of this houses of Akzib, I don't remember what I wrote in my commentary, but that word means deceit. Yes, I did explain this in my commentary. That word means deceit, and perhaps that's why the name of this town was chosen, was singled out in Micah's prophecy, because it means deceit. And therefore, it's really being used allegorically here and not literally. His name Akzib in Israel. One of them was in Judah.
Oh, we've lost you, Bill.
User in your channel, time's
up.
Yeah, he'll be back in a minute.
Raptured.
Well, if you look at verse 7, it speaks of all the graven images thereof be beaten into pieces, and all the highs thereof shall be burned with fire, and all the idols thereof will I lay desolate, for she gathered it of the hire of a harlot. And that's talking about all the ancient pagan cults were whore cults, where like whores would literally serve the temple and would be collect money for the temple with prostitutes. And so everything that was gathered in was the hire of a harlot. And here Yahweh saying, and they shall return to the hire of an harlot. So they're going to get repaid just as they gathered in.
Yeah. And Solomon writes about that in his wisdom, that by which men sin, so are they punished.
I think in ancient Babylon, I remember this now, is that like young women would have to go to a certain district in the city and they'd have to sit down and wait for a man to flick them a silver coin. And as soon as he flicked them the silver coin, they would have to go and sleep with that man. And then they would take the coin and give it to the temple, and that coin would be holy. And that was, I think that was the cult of Astaroth. And so the ancient Israelites were actually getting involved in that kind of, you know, idolatry. And all the pagan cults were like that. They had whores working for the temples and collecting for the temple.
Yeah, Herodotus mentions it too. Hey, Bill, you there?
Yes, I hope I can stay here.
Okay, this sounds a lot better. Can you go back to what you were talking about concerning Akzib?
Yeah, I don't know how much y'all heard, but Akzib is actually a word that means deceit. And there were actually a couple of towns in ancient Israel that were named Akzib. I don't know why anybody would want to live in a place called Akzib. I don't get it. But it was a town in Judah and a town in Asher near the Sea of Galilee, which are mentioned in scripture. And they were given this name, Akzib. I don't know why the King James translators decided to translate Akzib here as a proper noun, as if Micah was referring to one of those towns. In my opinion, he's only saying the houses of deceit. And other translations follow the King James in this, the houses of Akzib, that the New American Standard Bible does. The Septuagint, though, translated it simply as vanities, the house of vanities. So I think that actually did better. The word Akzib in Hebrew is not preceded by an article or any, there's no other indication that it should be read as a proper noun. It's just houses of deceit. So, I mean, we see it's evident that Micah does use a lot of place names allegorically, and Lachish seems to be one of those place names, that Lachish is being used allegorically here to describe the gate of Jerusalem, perhaps. But evil came down from Yahweh unto the gate of Jerusalem, O thou inhabitant of Lachish, and Lachish is in Judah. But it seems to me that here that word is being used allegorically, that Lachish is being used as a model because the people of Jerusalem think that they're invincible and that they can't be taken by the Assyrians. So Akzib, I would have translated that as deceit here if I was translating the Old Testament from Hebrew, just like the Septuagint translators had.
And they were taken because they were involved in idolatry, the lie. So the word Akzib is the lie. That's what they were doing. That was their sin. And they thought they were invincible, which is Lachish.
Yes.
So that's those ones. But then you've got in verse 15, yet will I bring an heir unto thee, O inhabitant of Morashah, and he shall come into the Adullam, the glory of Israel. And from your commentary, Bill, you mentioned that Marashah is the summit, and so that was taken possession by the Edomites. So that's like the peak of society has been taken control by the Edomites. They now control society.
Yes.
And so that's the summit. Marashah is the summit. It's been taken control of by the enemy, yet the justice of God is Adullam. So the heir will come to Adullam, the glory of Israel. Well, Adullam means the justice of God. I'm just checking that now.
That will throw down the summit. Yes.
Yeah. The justice of the people, the glory of Israel. So what we see is that in the end, the summit, you know, will be retaken through the justice of God.
Yes, and even the word, the name Moresheth Gath is related to the idea of occupying a place by driving out the previous inhabitants, and that's how Strong's defined it, to expel and take possession of the previous inhabitants. So that's in my commentary, that's how Strong's defined it. So all of these names are being used allegorically here in order to tell, to relate a prophecy. And it seems to me that this is a prophecy of Christ.
In your commentary, sorry,
the kingdom would be seized by another people, in this case the Edomites. And Marishah was the town where the Maccabees first started forcibly converting the Edomites to Judaism, into what I have to call Judaism for lack of a better term, in the second century BC, were Dor and Marishah, which Josephus had called Marissa in Greek. Dor and Marissa was where John Hyrcanus first started converting those Edomites that had taken over those cities after the children of Israel and Judah were deported by the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The Edomites took over those cities and a lot of other places too, where they were forcibly converted later on. But that's the two cities, Dor and Marissa, where those conversions began. It's mentioned in Josephus, Antiquities, Book 13. And here we have that description here. Therefore shalt thou give presents to Moresheth Gath. Well, I'm looking for the earlier Marishah. It's later. Yet I will bring an heir unto thee, O inhabitant of Marishah. In other words, it seems like the inhabitants of Marishah are being placed in opposition to this heir. That's how it seems to me.
They killed Christ. So what happened in Marissa, bringing the Edomites into Jerusalem, into the body of the people, eventually led to the justice of God, because when the Edomites killed Christ, that brings forth the justice of God, because now that Christ has died for our sins through wicked hands, you know, that's the law of God coming through these Edomites. They took the high places in society, and then they killed Christ, which brings in the justice of God. That's sort of what's happening today. The Edomites have taken the high places in our society, and through that transgression will bring forth the justice of God, because that's what happened in when Christ died, when he was killed by the Edomites.
Although Adullam means justice of the people in relation to the children of Israel, it has to be the justice of God, because it's the glory of Israel. Their only justice is justice from God. So yes, I agree with that. And that's what I explained roughly along those same lines in my commentary 10 years ago.
Yeah, I was reading that. And I've read it a couple of times, but it's telling a story, isn't it? It's telling the story that we're seeing today through the names of those towns.
Right. It's a story that goes beyond the literal word, because the names of each of those towns has meaning. Then the story is beyond the literal word, and you have to look at the meanings of the names of the towns in order to have the complete story. There's another precedent for that in the messages to the seven churches. In a revelation. It's not really a precedent. It's in a corroboration later of that style of prophecy.
It seems that's all through the Old Testament. The Hebrews had names that had significance in prophecy and things like that.
Yes, the names of people especially.
Another part which shows the interpretation is true is the juxtaposition between verses 15 and 16. Because in 15, the Edomites are coming in, and in 16, the Israelites are going out.
Right. I want to see what I wrote about it. Sapphire is a place is unknown. The Septuagint has Sinan here in Greek letters, which Breton writes as Sinar, but it is obviously the same place as Zanon. The verse is fragmented and the word cannot be read. The Dead Sea Scrolls. The word Sapphire in the Hebrew manuscripts is interpreted as fair or beauty. And as it appears there, it is said to be a noun, which appears without gender or number. The same grammatical form is used of the place names throughout the book of Joshua, where the towns of each tribe are listed. The phrase having thy shame naked, which is perhaps a play on words of Genesis chapter 2, verse 25, seems to infer that the children of Israel are sinning shamelessly and out in the open, much like they often do today.
Yeah, and that word saphir means beauty, right before having thy shame naked.
Yes, which is a reference to sinning out in the open, like they did in Genesis chapter 2. Or Genesis chapter 3, anyway. Zanon seems to be a variation of the spelling of Zanon mentioned in Joshua 15, which was a town of Judah. Both forms of the word seem to mean pointed. Beth Ezel means house of narrowing, something that's pointed. It may be that Micah, being a native of this area, which he prophesies against, demonstrates an intimate knowledge of its smallest villages and towns. It may also be that he is not referencing places here at all, but rather his words are meant to be interpreted literally. This would explain the Septuagint reading of Micah 1:11, which has the inhabitant of Sinar fairly inhabiting her cities, came not forth to mourn for the house next to her. She shall receive of you the stroke of grief. So some of the words weren't interpreted as towns, they were interpreted literally. The careful observer of the differences in these two versions may discover that in the King James Version, Sapphire is a place, while in the Septuagint, it is an adverb, fairly. It is apparent that both observations of Micah's intent are true, that certain and even obscure places are being singled out by the prophet because of the meanings of their names. Thereby, each of those names are being used as double entendres. Of course, a double entendre is a word or phrase that has two different meanings, and both of them are true. Micah prophesies against all of these places, yet the meanings of the names that he uses are also pertinent to his intended message. The meanings, he's singling out places, but the meanings of their names are actually probably more significant in his intended message.
Did we mention Meroth in verse 12?
For the inhabitant of Meroth waited for carefully for good, and that's the inhabitant of bitterness.
Yeah, or bitter springs is what I find, but yeah.
So they were waiting for good. They thought they were going to get good because I guess the false prophets were whispering in their ear, but they only got evil because they were sins for their sins, I'm guessing.
Again, Meroth is not known from anywhere else in the Bible. Once again, the lexicon states that Meroth is a noun without gender or number, and there is no definite article. The Septuagint version reads, "Who has begun to act for her that dwells in sorrow? For calamities have come down from Yahweh upon the gates of Jerusalem." So the Septuagint rendered as dwells in sorrow, the words translated here as inhabitant of Meroth, as they are in the King James Version, taking a literal meaning of the noun rather than interpreting it as a place name. So I would say it's fine to interpret it as a place name here, but what the message is really in its literal meaning, inhabitant of bitterness, which would be in a Septuagint, her that dwells in sorrow, or inhabitant of sorrow, if you will.
So that's, it's saying that what they're going to get is sorrow in exchange for their sin. They wait for good, but they're not going to get good. Evil came down from Yahweh unto the gate of Jerusalem. So they're dwelling in sorrow, even if they don't know it. And when the evil comes, then they're going to know it. They're going to get evil instead of the good that they expected, that they unrighteously awaited for because they were sinning. When we sin, we cannot expect good things to happen to us.
And the level of sin was pretty profound. Like, they were using temple prostitutes.
They were probably using weird pronouns.
So you're not going to get any good from that.
And wearing pink hair and stuff like that.
Well, call me crazy, but I think that nuns are kind of like temple prostitutes today, to be honest, like in the Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches. I don't believe that they're virgins. I mean, maybe some are, but I think they're essentially the modern version of whores.
Did you ever go to school with nuns?
No.
Well, I did for 4 years of my life. And I'll tell you, if they weren't virgins, then there's some pretty damn hard up priests.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of the nuns I knew were kind of rough. I mean, some of them, I mean, you never saw them, right? You only saw their face and only the front of their face. You never saw their hair. I never saw their hair or any part of their body, that they were totally covered from head to toe. In these habits, they call them, you only saw their faces. So, I mean, some of them look like they, I remember, might have been kind of attractive if they had regular clothes on. But no, most of them looked rough. I like to joke that my fourth grade nun, Sister Helen Victoria, she had a face like a leather football and eyes carved into it.
Yeah, I mean.
And that's exactly how it looked.
I mean, what I really mean is, like, as a group, I think that they just represent the same concept as the pagan whore temples.
Well, they do. They absolutely do. It's somebody devoted to the temple who is set out to work for the temple. Now, that doesn't have to be prostitution. It could be any other thing that the temple can make money off. It can be working in the field for the temple. It could be working in the meat markets or the butcher, the shambles as they're called.
Right, and what they do, what they do in modern times, and really for the last, I don't know, 1500, 1700 years since they created that. I don't think it was created originally in the 4th century, but anyway, they are making money by doing things like teaching children. Right, people are paying tuition, and they got these people, these nuns out there teaching. You know, for a pittance, and so it's the same thing, right? But I'm sure there is a lot of from your channel. And I mean, they raise money in other ways, because who's not going to give a nun of money if they're Catholic, right? It's like, if she's asking for $5 on a she comes into your flower shop or something, you're gonna say, okay, here's $5, go away please, you know? So I mean, it's essentially the same thing.
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say, you know, nuns are totally equal to someone who's literally a prostitute for the temple.
But I think that the concept of them are. I don't mean like each and every individual nun. I just mean that the concept is the same as the ancient world, where like Herodotus called them the horae. And I think that's where we get the word horror, right? It was like, you know, the sluts that worked at the temple, which were actually having sex for money when the temple took from them. And then in the Christian era, or at least the Catholic era, it kind of changed. But, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of debauchery in the meantime. It's the same concept that, they, like Bill was saying, that they do some type of work to make that church money. Right? And that's their real purpose.
I think the sins of the ancients were a lot more grievous, because they were producing, we'll see in the next chapter, they were producing, you know, illegitimate offspring who work evil on their beds.
The Horae were originally the goddesses of the seasons. in Greek mythology. I don't know. I'd have to try to look the term up, David, which I'm going to do.
Okay.
But in the ancient temples, they didn't just have female prostitutes. They also had little boys.
Well, they have altar boys now.
Joe. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, but the priests of today
are like... It's not a big difference. It's just that we don't... You know, we don't believe that this evil shit really happens, and it's certainly not reported on to a great degree, but it does. And even still, I'm saying as a group, that's what those two groups represent. Right? I really believe it. You know, like, why would you have a boy or a group of boys as altar boys, right? Like, where's the biblical reference for that? Where did Paul talk about having an army of kids, like, you know, passing you the candles and stuff? It's something that it's a holdover from the pagan times, just like the nuns are. You know, so again, like, it's probably much more difficult to get away with the things it did in the ancient world, but I'm sure that still happened. But as a group, it was just something that was, was a new manner of the same thing. I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying, or am I not being really explicit? Like,
well, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, you know, they sold slaves or people that had slaves, dedicated slaves to temples. Not all of those slaves were fit for prostitution. There were male slaves and female slaves, and they did a lot of other things besides prostitution. Even though prostitution was probably the most lucrative thing you could do for the temple.
One of the funny things in one of your wisdom commentaries, Bill, is you're talking about how the young women had to go to this precinct, had to sit down and wait for a man to chuck them a coin. Then when they got the coin, they were released from that duty and they'd give the coin to the temple. Well, some women were sitting down in that precinct for 3 or 4 years and couldn't get a coin.
Right.
So they became nuns, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that these new groups, like of nuns and altar boys, substituted for the old groups.
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah, I mean, that's...
And again, like...
I think, David, you might be a little confused with the use of hore. I mean, they were ministers of the gods, female ministers of the gods, yes. But I don't know that they worked in temples, that was the title of somebody who worked in temples. I don't know. I'd have to see that.
That's how I recall it, but... You know, you might be right. But regardless of what they were called, we know that there were whore temples, right? Or sorry, temple whores. I keep saying whore temples. But I guess it's the same thing.
Well, temple whores were common all over the ancient pagan world.
Yeah, they might not have been called whore, but I remember Herodotus saying that there were whore and they had a certain important position at the temples. So I might have confused that with the common whore at the temple, and you're saying that it was more like a female priestess. Is that right?
Yes, and very often the whores of the temples were boys, or young men.
Well, there you go.
And it's a lot of people today don't even realize this. They say, "Look, I'm a pagan," and they have no idea what a pagan really was.
Right. They've grown up with Christian values, whether they'll recognize it or not. Our entire society is founded on Christian values and has been perpetuating and operating on Christian values for between 1,000 and 1,800 years, depending on where you're from in Europe. Well, they're ingrained into our culture, and people don't realize to what degree they're ingrained into our culture. So they think that they could be pagans and have the same values, but if they were pagans, their value set would be absolutely different and foreign to Christianity. I mean, some pagans already had pretty debauched values, but no, they would be raised in a totally different world where basically dog eats dog, might is right, and they're never going to have anything. And they're going to be somebody's slave or somebody's whore. In a pagan world, and they're not going to have a choice. And there is no democracy. It's just the law of the jungle.
You know, but correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but I do think that there were some men that were wealthy enough to pay the Horae, even if they were priestesses, to have sex with them. It was like something exclusive to the rich. I think that's the way Herodotus described it.
You're stuck on that point, David.
Well, I just can't help myself, I guess.
I'm sure, but I sort of kind of remember some scandals about the Vestal virgins not really being virgins and shit like that. In Rome. I'm sure it happened. Money talks, right? Money talks whether you're pagan or Christian, no matter. If you don't have sound principles and morals, money talks. If you don't fear God, then money talks. I think the record is clear that most people throughout most of history have had no fear of God, no matter what they professed.
Another point maybe I just thought of is people think they're doing the work of God even when they're not, because they don't read the Bible. So they might be doing like a pagan work and think they're working for Yahweh. And they're not. So they're actually working for the whore temple while thinking they're working for Yahweh. It's not, you know, they'll go to a missionary in some shithole country and think they're doing the work of God, but what they're really doing is working for the whore temple.
Yeah, but I think that in the resurrection, even that will also be for the glory of Yahweh. All of that, right? Like everything will be, understood. Right, so all these evil acts, I think, are still for his glory. And that's why he allows it.
Yeah, when they realize that they devoted 30 years to going to Haiti and helping niggers, and it results in absolutely nothing.
No reward.
I mean, it's going to be a hell of a lesson. You know, in some ways, it's actually be very rewarding for them.
The lesson is they should have actually read the word of God to see what the work of God would be, so they could have done the works of God.
I just mean going forward, right, after the resurrection, they'll be like, oh, I really learned my lesson.
User in your channel, you know? Timed out.
I mean, if that sounds...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's hard to do the work of God in Haiti, though.
How about that guy that let his wife have two black kids?
Yeah, and he denies it. You know, there's one race, the human race, so who knows? He doesn't need a DNA test.
No, that's you're talking about a new guy from South Africa, Joe. I'm talking about a guy a couple of years ago from Tennessee or from Alabama or Mississippi, I think.
Oh, okay. What'd he do, Bill?
He purposely allowed his wife to get impregnated, supposedly artificially. I don't know if that's true or not. And have two black kids, two nigger kids.
You gotta be kidding me. Whoa.
He was doing God a favor. I used to have pictures in a podcast at Christigenia, but I don't remember where it is. That was probably about 2015 or 16 or something.
Oh, well, I reckon we should move on to Micah chapter 2.
I think Martin agrees.
It's a good chapter.
Micah chapter 2. Woe to them that devise iniquity and work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they practice it in the power of their hand. And they covet fields and take them by violence, and houses and take them away. So they oppress a man and his house, even a man and his heritage. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh, behold, against this family do I devise, ye shall not remove your necks, neither shall you go haughtily, for this time is evil. In that day shall one take up a parable against you, and lament with a doleful lamentation, and say, weep utterly spoiled. He has changed the portion of my people. How has he removed it from me? Turning away, he has divided our fields. Therefore, you shall not have none that shall cast a cord by lot in the congregation of Yahweh. See ye not, say they to them that prophesy, they shall not prophesy to them, that they shall not take shame. O you that are named the house of Jacob, is the spirit of Yahweh straitened? Are these his doings? Do not my words do good to him that walks uprightly? Even of late my people has risen up as an enemy. You pull off the robe with the garment from them that pass by securely, as men averse from war. The woman of my people have you cast out from their pleasant houses, from their children have you taken away my glory forever. Arise ye and depart, for this is not your rest, because it is polluted. It shall destroy you, even with a sore destruction. If a man walking in the spirit and falsehood do lie, saying, I will prophesy unto thee of wine and of strong drink, he shall even be the prophet of this people. I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as the flock in the midst of their fold. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker has come up before them. They have broken up and have passed through the gate and are gone out by it, and their king shall pass before them, and Yahweh on the head of them. End of Micah chapter 2.
You know, what people do in their own bedrooms can never be evil. We can never question it. There's no such thing as evil upon their beds.
Well, as I had explained in my commentary, that's not really, I mean, it might include having illicit sexual intercourse upon your bed or whatever, but it really means that you're devising evil as you sleep at night. Oh. You're devising iniquity. You're working evil. In other words, you're plotting of what to do in the morning. And when the morning is light, they practice it. So they lay in their beds all night saying, how am I going to fuck that guy? I want his wife, or I want his car, or I want something from him. I want his house because it's a nice estate. So I want to figure out a way to screw him out of it. They lay at night awake in bed and plot this evil of how they're going to get somebody else's stuff or somebody else's wife or whatever. And then in the morning when they wake up, they go practice that. They go attempt to do that. And that's probably basically how the enemies of God think, that they look for victims that they think that they could exploit or sue for some matter or some other matter and get their estates from them or get their possessions from them.
The mind of a cock.
Yeah. But Paul tells us. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's a trap that our own people fall into all the time. They think that it's sport. That they think it's a sport and that it's acceptable because they could do it. And here in relation to that very verse, I cited Amos chapter 3, where it says, for they know not to do right, saith Yahweh, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces. In other words, everything they gain is by violence and robbery. Whether that robbery is at gunpoint or in a courtroom doesn't matter, or in unfair trading practices on a stock market floor. It doesn't matter how you're robbing. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, an adversary there shall be even round about the land, and he shall bring down thy strength from me, and thy palaces shall be spoiled. And then I cited Amos chapter 5, for as much therefore, and he's speaking to the children of Israel, for as much there, the princes of Israel, for as much therefore as your treading is upon the poor, and ye take from him burdens of wheat, ye have built houses of hewn stone, but you shall not dwell in them. They're going to be punished for oppressing the poor, their own people, for their own gain. And we're in that situation again today where the poor, and I wrote this back then, the poor were are burdened with taxes and corrupt courts and unrighteous government, and the rich benefit from the oppression of the poor.
And we also have the enemy in the land bill.
Yes. Yes, we do. Who's encouraging all of it. It was the same way then. So then I also cited Amos chapter 8, where it talks about the merchants that make the ephah small and the shekel great. And today they're doing that same damn thing. I mean, okay, the ephah is made small. You know, when I was a kid, before I went to prison in the 90s, when I went and bought a box of pasta, it weighed a pound. It always weighed a pound. You go to the supermarket and grab any box of spaghetti or macaroni or any rigatoni, and you'll know that it weighs 16 ounces. And today I pick up a box of pasta and it'll weigh 13.5 ounces. But the price went up, plus the amount went down. So the ephah became small and the shekel became great. It's the same shed.
They're robbing us continually with their schemes.
In fact, European beer comes in 11-ounce bottles instead of 12-ounce bottles. And I'm like, what the hell? I'd rather have a 12-ounce bottle and just charge me a 12-ounce prize. It's in a lot of products on the supermarket shelves.
I've seen memes like that, Bill, where they'll show like chocolate bar from 1980 and it's like 500 grams. And then it's got like chocolate bar from 2022 and it'll say now even bigger, but it's like half the size of the one from 1980 or 1990 or whatever.
Yeah, now they're like $3. I remember when I was in second grade, I paid a nickel for a candy bar that was twice the size of the ones they sell today.
Yeah.
And
they're always
5 cents.
Shrinking.
That didn't last. That inflation of the early 70s raised them to a quarter before I graduated from grammar school.
What is it? At verse 11, it says, if a man walking in the spirit and false. Oh, okay. So he's walking in the spirit of falsehood. I thought it might be that's an Adamic man because he's walking in the spirit and he lies. So he's guilty. Yeah.
Well, the enemies of God, that they always set up their markets and their banks in our nations or any nations other than their own. And they set them up in order to take advantage of people, and they pit people against one another and divide us so that we now have, instead of a high trust cohesive society, we, like you said, we now have a low trust society that's based on individualism, and capitalism is really trying to make capital off one another. And there's always going to be winners and losers and people that are more savvy at marketing and trading that are able to build themselves palaces and store up robbery in them. That's all over this country.
You know what's sad? And this reminds me of a verse, something Christ said, where he said, the sons of this age are more faithful than the sons of the kingdom or something like that. Because what happens in Australia is a family of Chinese will move over and they'll all put their resources together and they'll buy as many houses as they can.
We might have the enemy in the land, but we, not we personally, but a lot of us go along with that enemy and pattern ourselves after his ways.
Well, they do that
everywhere.
Just
like he does.
Right, Joe?
And that way he could hide.
The thing is,
that way he could look normal.
White people used to do that. White people used to do that, right? Like they would live as a family together, even like usually it would be like the eldest.
If we didn't go along with the enemy would not look normal and he'd stand out and we'd be a lot more successful at getting rid of him and rooting him out.
like they convinced us that, you know, like living with their parents is like the worst shame, but the eldest son usually would live with his wife and kids with the father.
Too many of them, too many of us follow right after him in his ways, and that's the people that this is addressing.
Sorry, what was that, Joe?
When the poor, when somebody in poverty loses his house, it's no, really no big thing because he's living in a rundown shack anyway.
Bill, do you hear us?
And has no possessions anyway, nothing to speak of. It's better to be poor in times of trouble than it is to be wealthy and lose everything. The poor people, they were probably happy to go to Assyria.
Yeah, I don't think he does. You don't hear us, right, Bill?
Yeah. Well, while he's not talking, I was just going to say that, like, the Chinese are more faithful to their own kind than we are to ours, because a lot of white people, like you're saying, will devour each other while the enemy...
If a man walking in the spirit of falsehood does lie, saying, I will prophesy under thee of strong wine and of strong drink, he shall even be the prophet of this people. That's because that's all they deserve, Joe. That's what they deserve. They deserve false prophets. Sinners deserve false prophets.
They definitely do. They deserve to
be
lied to. And
we see that today all over the place. Prophet in the sense of somebody interpreting the word of God for them. This last verse, the breaker has come up before them. They have broken up and have passed through the gate. That's speaking about the invading armies, and are gone out by it, and their king shall pass before them, meaning the king of the opposing armies, and Yahweh on the head of them, meaning that Yahweh is leading the Assyrians in to take Israel into captivity because they need to be punished for these sins. But there's a promise of assembly or reconciliation in that captivity in the previous verse, in verse 12. I think I lost my speaker.
Yep, you did.
Wow.
User disconnected from your channel.
He'll be back in a sec.
Yeah.
User entered your channel.
I don't know how that happened.
Is it raining there?
I still have no speaker.
Can you hear me?
No. Now, well, we got through chapter 2, I think.
Yeah, we did.
Do any of y'all have anything to say?
Verse 12 with Bozrah is sort of weird until you realize that Bozrah means sheepfold. And it makes a lot of sense. Because you would be wondering, why are they going to Edom, right?
User entered your channel.
Yeah, yeah, because Bozrah is in Edom.
Yeah, exactly. But the word Bozrah means sheepfold. So it's just a matter of translation.
Yeah.
Where the Assyrians are called the breaker here, it sort of reminds me of what the army of locusts are called in Revelation. And I know that army of locusts, they're Muslims. They're not white. The Assyrians here are actually white, but it still reminds me of it. They're called like the destroyer in Revelation chapter 9. I'd have to go check.
That reminds you of the locust because they're called the breaker.
Yeah, okay, so whose name, this is Revelation 9:11, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has a name, destroyer. So like breaker, destroyer.
User entered your channel.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear us?
Yeah, now I can. I have no idea what happened. All of a sudden, all of my audio devices were dead. I'm sure you heard me. I don't know how much you heard of what I said.
I could hear everything you're saying.
Yeah.
You just couldn't hear us.
it was really edifying, okay. Actually.
I've had a hell of a couple of weeks with tech. I don't know why. I don't change anything here.
So you're not on Windows 11?
No, this is Linux.
Is it raining?
All of a sudden, I found that all my audio devices were force muted, but I didn't do anything. It's kind of weird.
Serious question. Is it raining there?
No, it had threatened to about 2 hours ago, but it didn't.
Oh, okay. Because sometimes when you have a storm, you have problems, right?
I think it is.
Yeah, Melissa said there's some lighting, but no, all of my audio devices were set on force mute, but I didn't do a damn thing.
It's some software you added that Logitech thing.
I can't add nothing to this computer because I have no room left. I have to reinstall my operating system on a bigger card. I have to do that soon. I got 4 gig left on my NVMe card.
Why are you using NVMe for storage?
I'm sorry?
I thought NVMe storage was for like the boot up, and then you'd use like an SSD or a HD. Hard disk drive for storage, because NVMe, I didn't know people usually use that for storage.
User entered your channel.
It's not for storage, it's for my root directory.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Only my root directory in my operating system, but I have so much software installed that I've beaten it all up.
Wow, okay.
And I have to have a bigger one. I only got 4 gig free on like 256 gigabytes. So I bought a terabyte NVMe card about 2 months ago, but I haven't put it in yet because I have to actually reinstall the operating system when I do it. All my storage, I got 4 other or 5 other hard disks in this computer. I've got like 9 terabytes of storage, I think, or something like that. Maybe more.
Actually, I've got 4 hard disks, but I've got one that's 8 terabyte, one that's 2. And then 2 SSDs that are 1 terabyte each. So I've actually got more than you.
Wow.
Because well, I have a different.
I got a 4 terabyte on a shelf that's slated to replace a 1 terabyte soon, but I haven't done that yet.
Hey guys, this podcast is in English, so the rest of us don't know what you're talking about.
So I might catch up to you soon, Joe.
Yeah. Well, I've got a dual boot with one. So I'm on Windows 7 now because I just switched it. It boots up real quick on the SSD, and then each one's got a hard drive for that operating system. So I've got Linux with an 8 terabyte hard drive on an SSD, and then I've got Windows 7 with a 2 terabyte hard drive. So that's a lot of storage.
I hear you're German too.
But how much memory do you have?
Hey,
this machine's a dual boot too, but right now on the second partition is nothing.
I have a question. Actually, it's Noble's question about the breaker in the last verse, verse 13. I don't know if you want to ask it again, Noble, but.
Oh, it wasn't really a question. It was just an observation.
Yeah, he just feels that the breaker is like the destroyer.
It just reminded me of Revelation 9, where the locusts are called the destroyer.
I just thought we'd flagged this podcast after, because we got it all in there, basically. Bill didn't hear some of the stuff we were saying. I thought we'd just sort of covered it, and it, you know, and it was all sort of falling apart, so I thought we just flagged it. Eh?
Yeah, let me just answer Noble. In my commentary, and that's what how I would interpret it today, the breaker was those who were going to come that Yahweh would use to pass judgment on Israel. That's why in my comments a few minutes ago here, I likened the breaker to the invading armies.
Yeah, I know it's the Assyrians, it's Asher, but it just reminded me of Revelation 9, where the locusts are coming in to punish Byzantium, and they're called the Destroyer. And then here, the Assyrians are coming in to punish Israel, and they're called the Breaker. So I just see symmetry, that's all.
Yes, there is. That's a fair analogy. But I think that's more or less natural, perhaps. But it is symmetrical.
Was Bozrah always controlled by the Edomites, Bill?
Like yeah, Micah 2:12. In the land of Edom, I believe.
Yeah, so there you go.
No, it's a town in Edom, but it's also a town in Moab, evidently.
Oh, okay, so this could be the Moab. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah.
But wouldn't Israel have controlled Bozrah in the time of David?
Yes, but it would have still been a subject city, Edomite city, right?
So we just have a governor?
Well, it's not really literal, Joe. It's more like the sheep of the sheepfold. I don't think it's talking about a literal place.
Yeah, both of them mean sheepfold. And Noble's right. It may have been translated.
Yeah, most of the modern translations do actually translate it. So there you go. So I was just asking for the other possibility, Noble. I understood you. I was just asking.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So Micah 3 is only 12.
It is translated in the Septuagint and in the Latin. And the Douay Rheims translation, and in the New American Standard Bible. It's translated into sheepcote or sheepfold or... I want to see the Hebrew real quick. There's no article in front of it. It shouldn't have been translated as a place name, in my opinion. It didn't have to be, that's for sure. It should have been translated.
Petra was the capital of Edom, right?
That's what I am persuaded, is that Petra was Mount Seir, but modern Israeli maps will put Petra being like 10 or 12 miles from another mountain they identify as Mount Seir. I don't know why they make that identification. A lot of British Israel people and British Israel writers also identified Petra as Mount Seir, but the Jews say otherwise. I don't know what basis they do. Okay. Just to review 12 again, I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as the flock in the midst of their fold. That's a parallelism. So I would translate that. I will put them together as the sheep of the sheepfold, as the flock in the, or as the sheep of the sheepcote or whatever, as the flock in the midst of their fold. They're both saying the same thing, basically. Parallelism.
Bozrah is mentioned so much, like it makes you feel like Bozrah is the capital.
You know, the Septuagint was wrong. It actually has, I missed a word here, which means trouble or tribulation. when I just gave the Greek a precursory look, it's sheep in trouble. I will put them together as sheep in trouble, as a flock in the midst of its barn or bed, or however you want to, you could translate that as fold, since it's pertaining to sheep. So whatever word stood in place of Bozra in certain manuscripts, that's what it seems to be, because they can't translate Bozra as trouble, but perhaps there was some other word there that meant trouble or tribulation.
Sheep of Jacob's trouble.
I think that's enough of Micah for this evening. I'm sorry, I have tech problems. I've had tech problems. Twitter, I did a Twitter interview. I posted it, a link to it in the chat, but I didn't publicize it or anything. I did a Twitter interview for some people. They just wanted to talk to me about CI. They were on the fence about certain things like Wickstrom and stuff like that. The guy signed up for the forum today. Y'all saw his post already in the forum.
Yeah.
Son of Jacob. He had asked me a couple of weeks ago. I mean, we spoke on Twitter on and off for well over a year, probably over 2 years. But the conversations kept getting interrupted because I keep losing accounts. I've gotten away with a lot of stuff on his latest Twitter account. I posted all kinds of shit about niggers and Jews and used the word niggers. And it just says the visibility of that post is limited instead of banning me or anything. And I've gotten away with it so far. So we'll see. I'm going to keep going. Well, anyway, he asked me to come on a Twitter group with him. And I told him I'd do it last night, Tuesday evening. So I planned on half an hour, and then it turned into 1 hour, and then with the tech problems, it turned into 1.5 hours.